Merry Christmas!
Hello there, you've turned into Taking It Down, and this week we're here to talk to you about a couple of movies and the most recent episode of The Challenge. Luckily for you listeners, Donovan will not be singing today if we can stop it. No.
Daddy, don't listen to Mommy! Mommy, don't listen to Daddy! Daddy, don't listen to
Merry
Mommy!
Christmas, everyone.
Mommy, don't listen to Daddy! Because Daddy likes to dance, dance, dance! And Mommy likes to rest, rest, rest! Daddy, don't listen to Mommy! Mommy, don't listen to Daddy!
He's doing the full version.
No radio edits here.
We'll be discussing Mank.
I ain't talking about it. It's going to be Adam talking by himself.
Well, I want to hear what he thought there. And we will be, there will be actual discussion on the Bee Gees documentary from HBO and HBO Max titled How Can You Mend a Broken Heart? That's right, the Bee Gees. That's, we're going to talk about them, as well as the most recent episode of The Challenge, Double Agents, which we'll get to after the break. And don't forget that some year-end writing and lists are going to be popping up on the website, The Alabama Take, this week. So be sure to check those out. Let's get started. Guys, before I say hello to you officially, we've had reviews on the Apple podcast app for sure that I've seen, and I'm almost certain it's a friend of ours, Heather Stewart, or a friend of my family, Heather Stewart, and Casey, an old friend of mine from many years ago, and they both gave us 5-star reviews and noted that they loved listening, so I didn't want to get any further because that those reviews have been on there for about a week or two, so I almost forgot. I don't want to do that. So if you have not given us a rating on your podcast app, do so, and we'll say thank you on the air. Guys, I've got Donovan, obviously. He sang. We got Adam, who asked him not to sing. And that's who we got with us. It's our usual crew. Me, I'm Blaine Duncan. And I'll start with this. It seems like this week, maybe even last week, COVID started to feel entirely too serious or too close to home to be flipping about. I mean, I know we've joked about it, and that's usually my way of coping. I'm not trying to be offensive. My immediate response to anything, good or bad, is to make a joke about it. So apologies if I've offended anyone. I don't think I have, but it's just hitting closer and closer to home now. Y'all have thoughts on it?
I mean, my parents have had it for 6 weeks now, so yeah. It's been close to home.
I can't imagine trying to get through this pandemic in Alabama. Honestly, like, people up here are pretty good about wearing masks. Most people are fine. There was one guy out with a sign over the summer that said, open the goddamn bar, but he's probably dead now.
Okay, well, I mean, this guy will never listen to this podcast. So I'll in our hometown paper, published weekly, they've gone once a week now. Did I send you guys this editorial?
Yes. You did.
He says, I have not and will not wear a mask is the title that they gave the editorial. And he cites that he was born into a military family. He spent 20 years Army active duty, 4 years Army civil service, his whole adult life's in the service. His daughter did a tour. She did a combat tour. His son did an infantry tour. My wife did years in the Army. They're highly thought of in D.C. None of that matters anymore because he stepped to the dark side. That's literally a quote. Stepped into the dark side. You see, I refuse to bend to Kay Ivey's mask requirement. I guess that makes me a criminal. I haven't worn a mask yet and have no intention of wearing one in the future. I will not be controlled by someone that doesn't know her hiney from her elbow. Whew, strong language in such a reputable paper.
I mean, he probably voted for her, right?
Well, and then I'll wrap up with his last line, and I'll let you guys just feel free to say whatever. In fact, Kay Ivey can kiss my red, white, and blue butt cheeks.
There is a certain amount of, maybe comedy is not the right word, but like not comedy, like funny, ha-ha, but funny. And like, Alabama governor outflanked on the right. Very funny. I'm always sort of reminded of an Onion headline that reads, Alabama or area man passionate defender of what he imagines Constitution to be. It's kind of feels very germane.
I think it'd be almost irresponsible of us not to talk about the Mandalorian's recent episode, the last of its season. And Donovan, you watched it, I know.
I did watch it. I'm first off, you know, I'd be fine with a Star Wars series that doesn't have either Luke Skywalker or Han Solo as the exact center of the universe about which all others orbit. I mean, it was cool, but also it was like, oh, okay, here we go. The eugenics subplot is back.
I really was hoping Grogu would die.
Well, yeah, I know you were.
Yeah, I was hoping when, as soon as the dark saber, whatever that you want to call it, is was out, I was thinking, just chop him, just cut him in two. It'd be so bold.
So remember my very cranky discussion about Disney and Marvel last week? You will never get something really bold out of them. You might get things that are surprising, but I don't think you'll ever get something bold. If Baby Yoda gets cut in two, how the fuck are they going to sell dolls?
Well, now they can sell twice as many.
I guess you can. I was going to say you can sell your, you know, Baby Yoda now with detachable head.
There's plenty of Star Wars characters that died who sold dolls. Greedo was Jabba the Hutt.
Yeah, but this is you know, I don't think that's going to happen for something so marketable as Baby Yoda. Did they kill all the Ewoks? No, they sell.
There was a few dead Ewoks by the end of that battle.
Speaking of being bold and having guts, I kind of wish they would actually really double down on exploring this, where we've had last week we had an Imperial officer saying everyone says they want freedom, what they really want is order.
Yeah, that was a great
one. And this week we got a canonical Star Wars version of the Clerks contractor discussion. But also we got the T word got thrown around, terrorism, which still seems pretty resonant, right? Because you can get away with anything. The Department of Defense gave the Willimantic Police Department one of those other urban combat vehicles. They were built for fighting in Iraq, right? They got the big tires and, you know, because IEDs go. And the SWAT team has it for some damn reason. And I was grumbling about that to someone, and they said, well, as long as it's keeping people safe. And all I could think of is you can get away with anything as long as you're like, well, it's making people safe. You can blow up a whole damn planet as long as it makes people safe.
Except for wearing masks in Alabama, apparently.
Well, that's not blowing people up.
You gotta have a little shock and awe to really keep people safe.
That's way cooler.
Yeah.
So you were not a fan of the cameo?
I mean, it was cool, but it's like, oh, okay, cool. Here we go. Here's how it all orbits around the same shit we already knew about. Can't do anything new. Can't have anything fun. It's a big damn galaxy. You're telling me there's only five people in it?
I am excited with the fact that this does take away Grogu.
I was wondering if that was going to be your takeaway.
It is.
Now that
is this the end of the Mandalorian, and then we're about to shift into what was teased at the very end?
Well, you know, now he's got this plot where maybe he could rule Mandalore or whatever, right? Because he's got the Darksaber.
Interesting.
He's got the mandate, right?
So did you, I'm supposing you caught the little tack on at the end, the teaser.
Yeah, the Boba Fett teaser.
Uh-huh. And your thoughts on that?
Sure. It's happening.
Whether you like it or not.
Whether any of us likes it or not, the Star Wars universe is bearing down on us like a juggernaut.
So you sound like you're not happy with how the season ended.
I sound so cranky, but I thought I was overall pretty happy. I think
Star Wars fans and Alabama fans are kind of joined hands here. Like, yeah, it was fine.
I liked one Carlo Esposito a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping that Mando goes to the doctor after getting his brain pan staved in by a dark trooper.
It looked concussed.
I really like Juan Carlo Esposito. I really like, just, he did some kind of little subtle things. Like when Luke shows up and they cut to him and he looks absolutely terrified. He's great. I thought he was great. Well, you know, we had some fun. Good thing that they remembered to tell us that a Darksaber can't cut through Beskar right before it became very important. But yeah. I had, you know, it was fun. I had a fun time watching it. I did like the scene. You probably hated it, but I did like the scene, right, where he takes his helmet off to look at Grogu, although I thought it was a little bit undercut by them doing the helmet off last week.
It was, yeah. They had already done it, so.
Yeah, but it was good. I liked it. It was fun. It was also just like, as soon as Luke showed up, it's like, oh, of course. I thought it was cool they actually got Mark Hamill. I thought him going through the ship was cool. But
it really was. It was reminiscent, of course, as many people pointed out, of Darth Vader in Rogue One.
You actually get to
see him at his peak of his powers, which it feels like in the original trilogy, a lot of that stuff's just alluded to. You know, you get Darth Vader fighting Obi-Wan, and it doesn't play like two powerful Jedis should, especially compared to, and then you go back and watch episodes 1 through 3, and that's how they were kind of fighting. It's interesting.
It definitely plays like Alec Guinness is old and doesn't want to break his hip on set this week. Unlike Harrison Ford, who has no problem with breaking his hip on any set he goes on ever.
Exactly.
But I love that scene from Rogue One where Vader goes in.
I did too.
They played it like a horror movie.
It played like a horror movie. And
it was great.
Made that movie so much more exceptional than it could have been. In fact, I came out of that movie many years ago saying, the first half is probably one of the worst Star Wars movies I ever saw, and the back half is probably the best Star Wars movie I've ever seen.
It really grows on you.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, I feel like even in the first half, there's a lot of stuff I loved about it. You can see that there's like really, really obviously the studio meddled in it, because there are scenes that were left in that just never connect to anything else.
Yeah.
And, but that's my favorite of the new batch that we've had. Rogue One has been my favorite one. It feels like it has heft. Feels like it takes place in a real world, mm-hmm. just from the way it's shot and created.
Yeah, it does.
It's a little different. It's a little, you know, I don't know. I liked it.
I just remember thinking on Friday afternoon when I was watching this episode of The Mandalorian, you know, when the X-Wing flies in, I kept thinking, are they really going to do that? Is this really where they're going? But I mean, in a good way. I was thinking in a good, like, wow, that's pretty bold. Is that? And I kept trying to piece together, who could this be other than the obvious choice?
Mm-hmm.
And
they teased it pretty hard, right? You got the green lightsaber. You've got the black glove. It's a single X-Wing.
Anyway, I thought it was enjoyable. I thought that was, you seem less thrilled about it than I. And I am much less thrilled about it than the internet. But overall, I thought it was really good. And the show's really good.
I think I'm just being unduly pessimistic looking at a fan service future.
Okay. That rings true to me. Are we venturing way too much into fan service? I hate it and we've talked about this, you know, a couple of times on this podcast, where when a piece of work is dictated by what fans want, you know, what's going to make them cheer on Twitter. I cringe at it, but every now and again, it'll make me happy. But most of the time I just think,
I mean, I so strongly disliked, Rise of Skywalker, whatever it was.
Oh, that last one.
Like, I thought it was just, first off, I thought it was a bad movie.
It was horrible.
And then secondly, it felt like a whole middle finger to the movie that came before it. And there were just so many, like, you know, I want the fans to cheer bits. It sucked.
That was the biggest pile of shit on a movie screen I have seen in a long time.
It made me think about, like, even the first three, like the George Lucas movies, which I'm not going to argue are high art, but at least they were actually about something.
Yeah, they were.
Whereas I would be hard pressed if you put a gun to my head and said, What was this last Star Wars trilogy about? I'd be like, I don't know, believe in yourself? I have no idea.
I don't know either.
I mean, the first one was about how a fascist government votes itself into power. So if nothing else, I mean, I don't know if it was done well, but it was about something.
Even the prequels, I would say, you can make the argument that they are absolutely, is that what you're saying? That,
no, yeah, that's what I mean, fascism. The prequels.
That's when we went back and we decided to watch them all in order in the prequels. It's kind of shocking, like, how much plot is there and how much character development they attempted, and I don't know, that it is a dense universe compared to the expectations of the writer's room for the prequel is they think much more of the crowd. I know that sounds ridiculous all these years later when we know that Jar Jar is like a, you know, a punchline, and there's a lot of things about the prequels that are a punchline, but there's a fair amount going on. Like, you start a much-loved kids franchise by talking about a trade dispute, you know? Like, you're wandering into at least some thoughtful territory, even if it doesn't land.
That is 100% George Lucas right there, which I like. It doesn't, maybe, I don't, is it good? Who knows? Is it interesting? Sometimes.
I mean, I gotta say, between there are moments in the prequels where they let, you know, you alluded to like the lightsaber duels being pretty awesome in the prequels, if nothing else, and like getting to see Jedi unleash what they actually were all about after only having imagined that. Like, as a kid, I remember thinking, oh man, if there were a bunch of Jedis, that would be awesome. And then you see it on the screen and it was great. And the new stuff just doesn't seem to have that, the same sense of scale or
gravitas.
Yeah. Even obviously the prequels are a punchline often, but you can't condemn them for not being ambitious, at least.
Another weird thing that I felt after watching the last J.J. Abrams one, Rise of Skywalker, Jeez. Is we were jumping, like, every 20 damn seconds you were somewhere new, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was just here. And I realized, strangely, that the George Lucas prequel, maybe it's because I saw them as a kid, but I felt like they had so much of a stronger sense of place.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they did.
Than this one did, where it's like, sand planet number 3, cold planet number 2, you know. And here you've got, like, remember the time in episode 2 where George Lucas gave us a weird space diner with a weird space diner alien owner?
See, that stuff was more enjoyable to watch after having seen the latest Star Wars stuff. Like, when we went back, it's like, oh, this is fun. Like, when the car chase scene through the capital planet?
Coruscant.
That thing, the diner scene, all of the stuff versus like all the planets that they go to later in this new stuff are mostly abandoned. Just they're like just set pieces, yeah. And they don't really have any depth to them.
The last two episodes of The Mandalorian has really made me want to go through and set up everything in chronological order of that universe and watch it all the way through.
That'd be fun.
And I think that's a compliment to The Mandalorian. I think it is. But then I thought that process through to the end and thought, well, that would mean I'd have to watch that goddamn J.J. Abrams movie.
You would.
But I think I would just leave it off there. I would, like, my ending would be the Rian Johnson second movie of the third trilogy.
Which I thought was good.
It's fantastic.
Watching that one after watching the J.J. Abrams one, it's amazing how much of a, like, better put together movie it is. Like, it just looks more interesting.
And it was bold. You know,
the big scenes are cooler. Yeah, like, did it 100% work? No, but at least you could see what they were going for.
It would have been such a pleasure.
I liked it.
Yeah, me too. It took me 2 watches.
It was bold. It was bold.
It took me going through it twice before I realized, yeah, this is actually really good. And it would have been so pleasing for that third movie, that J.J. Abrams movie, The Rise of Skywalker or whatever, if they would have just picked up with what Rian Johnson had done and carried that on to a conclusion.
100% agree. Yeah. Anyway, it sucked. Whatever.
Well, speaking of 2 hours you won't waste, or more, actually a lot more than two. You guys have any thoughts on the recent Druid City Nightcap show that streamed online, and it's going to repeat, I think, on Christmas Day?
It'll I'll do the plugging part of that.
Yeah, because you performed in conjunction with it. So,
well, and I got a follow-up text from Bo yesterday.
Bo Hicks, the owner of Druid City Brewery in Tuscaloosa. That's what we're referencing here for our listeners.
He had a warm heart yesterday. Friday was good for everybody, I think. They raised a little over $7,000.
That's awesome.
I know that a small business, $7,000 can be a drop in the bucket in terms of what you're trying to do with moving and construction and all that stuff. But that's better than zero. And it,
and not to mention it's a pandemic. You know, any little bit will help a small business.
Yeah, and one that's
kind of certain. Yes,
it's based on a social environment.
Exactly.
That's what I was gonna say. So that's, and they've been having a rough year. And it was fun to see everybody. It was fun to see what different folks did for the stream, but it'll be on again on Christmas Day. I think they're just going to play it on a continuous loop instead of like appointment viewing. So, yeah, if you get a chance to tune in.
Which is nice.
Yeah.
And I would encourage them, maybe, I don't know if I could, if they're listening, I would encourage them to do that again on New Year's Eve or something. That would be a lot of fun to see it on a recurrent, because I'll still miss some performances, even if it's on a loop. But that's nice. On Christmas Day, while I'm sitting around, if there's some boring moments during Christmas Day for me, I can pull up my phone and watch a couple of performances and then go back to my ham and mac and cheese and corn. And I'm just going to list food from this point going forward. No, but Adam, your band El Rey performed. Tell me about the filming of that. You went in the studio, masked up, went in the studio, and you guys knocked out a couple. How many songs was it? Three?
Yeah, we did three.
Yeah,
and we'll,
they were great, by the way.
I hope that some folks, you know, didn't maybe have the time or the, we're spoiled living in the Shoals to be able to text a friend and say, hey, do you want to work on this thing that no one's getting paid for, but it's in a studio where Bob Dylan worked. It's like, yeah, okay, let's go in and knock it out, and it comes out sounding pretty good. So
it sounded great, and it was good songs. Natalie sounded great.
I thought so too.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. I hate that I didn't get to watch a lot more. I missed actually our friend Lee Baines the Third. I missed his, so I'm looking forward to the loop because I want to see what he did. I want to see what several others did. There were plenty of others that I also missed. But Hayden, I think Hayden Crawford came on just after Del Rey. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, and Lee was only one before, so you barely missed Lee.
Okay, so when Hayden came on, that's when I turned it off. Yeah, good. So I encourage people to watch that, and if you want to donate, I know that you may be suffering through a pandemic as well, but that, you know, they're a local business and friends of ours. Our friendship runs deep with those people. So check it out. Let's be clear on where you can check it out. I think they have a YouTube channel and they have a Facebook page, and they're going to run those loops on there, I think. And it shouldn't be too hard to find. Plus, they have Instagram pages and stuff. You can find links there. And Donovan, you were saying?
Last time I went through Tuscaloosa, like, so much of that city seems like it's gotten bulldozed and had condos built over it. Mm-hmm. And going to Druid City, it was like, this is a place that, like, the most important thing to them is, like, that people come and hang out and talk with each other and see each other. And that is not always what you get in breweries and things like that.
The Fred Rogers of breweries.
Yeah, it's really special.
Yeah, it is. So support them. I know you can't go. Well, you can go by there. You just have to drink outside, and in this weather, that might be a hassle. So you can support them in other ways. Let's shift gears. I sat down. I did not see this coming, people. But my boy Adam here on mic says, I'm going to watch this documentary on the Bee Gees, How Can You Mend a Broken Heart? And my first immediate thought was, no, I'm not watching that. That won't happen. But just so happened, I had a little break in work, and I thought, well, why not? And I watched it. And my first thought was, man, this documentary does not waste time.
It moved at a brisk pace, didn't it?
Very brisk. The thing is, it's an hour and 50 minutes long, but if you would have told me I had only watched a 30-minute documentary, you could have fooled me.
I'll tell you why I wanted to watch this. I saw a whole bunch of folks from Patterson Hood to my buddy Mike V that lives in North Carolina and is a great musician and art-aware guy, all the way to Jamie Seago, that is the engineer at the studio we did the Del Rey stuff at. He even reached out directly and said, you need to watch this Bee Gees documentary. And none of these people, they all come from kind of different musical backgrounds, a lot in common, but would not expect them to be big Bee Gees fans. at all. Mm-hmm. Probably even to think that it's kind of bullshit, but they sang the praises of it. And I watched it and I thought, oh, I get why. I get why a musician would be interested in watching this.
Okay. Dive into that. Tell me why. And you're a musician and work in the studio a lot and tour. So what about did you see that musicians would be drawn to?
I think a big part of it, like for Jamie, I know that a lot of the old studio shots were really interesting. With a band this big, they just had cameras around all the time. So if you enjoy looking at 60s, 70s, early 80s studio technology, it's kind of a feast. So that's very basic. But I think the other thing that surprised me was their work in the 60s, especially. Mm-hmm. I mean, that stuff sounded cool. The songwriting was still kind of, you know, melodramatic, Bee Gees stuff, kind of sad.
Little hackneyed.
Yeah, but like the drums and bass sounded awesome.
Yeah, they did. And one of the more fascinating studio moments was finding out that Staying Alive, that is not a recorded drummer. That's not like, well, they took snippets of a previous recording and slowed it down and put it together to form.
I mean, it's early looping.
Yeah, it's early looping.
You literally sit there, they show how they slice tape and piece it together and run it out and hang it over. It was a physical act, looping. Much of early hip-hop and rap was put together the same way of digging through these tracks and physically building loops. These are things that take 2 seconds in Pro Tools and Ableton and Logic now. But they demonstrated that was cool. That was kind of like I don't know if you guys are classic albums fans, that old program.
Of course. It's
a gold mine of stuff, but that was kind of the classic albums moment of like, here's really how we did it physically. Yeah. That was cool to see.
It really was. That was a fun documentary. And if I can be forthright, I do not like the Bee Gees. Staying Alive might be the one song I can listen to, you know, with a little regularity and not get too annoyed.
Yeah. It didn't change my opinion on their music, you know?
No, in fact, what it did for me is it helped me understand why I don't like their music and a lot of that music. It's because, and they seem like acceptable and very nice blokes. I really enjoyed spending time with them. I've never found songs that were too pristine that appealing. And much like the sound of the song, there's not a lot of grit. And the perfect example was that Saturday Night Fever soundtrack, where the lyrics are very earthly, you know? They're very grounded if you listen to them, which I haven't really paid much attention to them throughout the years. But they're grounded in about a rough time in New York City, but they're sang and with this upbeat, pristine, there's not a hint of a missed note anywhere. It just lacks the... It's very juxtaposing to actually sit down and read the lyrics and then hear the song. It just doesn't seem like it goes well together. And that's why a lot of music back then does. That's usually the music I do not like, if there's not just some grit to it. And Islands in the Stream, knowing that they wrote that song, made perfect sense to me. I was like, oh, that's why I've hated that song so much.
I think I agree with you. And there was a moment at the end where I can't remember which one was talking about it, but they said, you know, there's been people who were massive of their time and they kind of spoke for their moment, but all those people go away. They kind of fade into, like, as the years go by and they're kind of locked in place, but we managed to stay and be successful in different eras. And I thought that's true, but I'm not sure that it's something I would brag about, you know, because that means you're never really tied. Aside from Saturday Night Fever, the adaptability of like success at all costs, it kind of goes into what you're saying about the grit of a song, you know, like being in the moment and speaking to the moment is a powerful thing. And commercial viability as a motivating factor isn't, I'm usually not drawn to art where that's kind of the end all be all. You know, it's funny to say that because they are very timely. You know, you mentioned off mic about it kind of being maybe the thesis is that they're not just a disco band. That's what they were attempting to achieve, but
really did seem like the thesis.
But ultimately, they kind of are stuck in that time. But that adaptability, I don't know. I thought it betrayed a lot there at the end, and it's fine to approach art that way if that's your goal. It would just it explains to me why it doesn't resonate with me.
Still an excellent documentary. One of the better moments being when they started intercutting the people taking a stand against disco music in general, and then them performing a very great sold out show, and they would cut between the two. This demonstration against disco,
the famous the disco night at the White Sox game.
Yeah,
that's it. And you know, to that was tough, and that's like a cultural moment. That's the American studies moment of the documentary. It's trying to think about, you know, disco. They did a good job framing disco as something coming from the underground, both in terms of gay culture, which literally had to be underground at the time. That great moment where the former club owner DJ is talking about, you know, it was illegal for these things to happen. And then they finally made it okay for a group of dudes to all dance together in New York City so that the police couldn't come in and brutalize the scene. And this was the music of that moment. And that was all moving, and you understand the liberation side of it, but also the disco just became terrible and commercialized. And I think they all, he even agreed, you know, saying that once the music industry and capitalism at large sees profit, you just reproduce, and the reproductions get worse and worse. So by the end, like the former, them telling the story about the White Sox game and the fact that a lot of the records that were getting burned were just by black artists.
Yeah.
Or it wasn't, they weren't burning Bee Gees records. You know, you can understand why somebody would hate that if they loved rock and roll. You know, if you're a rock fan and you're only 10 years removed from the peak, you know, of a time where like the charts were just loaded with things that we would still consider classics, and all of a sudden the Bee Gees are getting shoved down your throat at every turn. I get it. I get why you would have a visceral reaction to that.
But they were bringing Marvin Gaye records and stuff that was just not disco.
That's where it gets complicated. It's like these are soul records, these are R&B records, and you start to realize this is racist, this is anti-gay, this is all these things that it's a more complicated scene. I don't know. That was kind of a tough pill to swallow.
A little eye opening there. Great documentary, though, and not, you know, maybe not what you think it is, though it kind of is what you think it is at the same time, but also very enjoyable and very well done.
There's a great AV Club review of it that both praised the parts that I thought were good and kind of called out what didn't work. They kind of fawn over the subjects. That's my only issue with it. And they seem like, you know, they were such adaptable, especially as they got older. They seem like kind people, more or less, well-respected in the industry, all these things. But, you know, they broke up for those years, and that's really the only moment of tension is them as young men kind of having a spat. And they don't touch on, they allude to, but don't really touch on, like, substance abuse problems that you know are present. I know that's...
Yeah, I was hoping they would go into that a little, just to hear more of their personal stories.
Yeah, it's a cliche to talk about, you know, somebody got two on the pills or two on the drink or whatever in a music documentary, but it does provide drama. And they also had some pretty horrific missteps in the 70s. Like, that Sgt. Pepper's movie is atrocious. You know, like, it was a failure on every level, and they just don't even talk about it.
That's a good point.
So there was a few moments that maybe would have livened it up a bit. But I thought it was still very good and had some, there's, you know, some human moments, like at the end, him saying, I would give back all the hits. It opens with him saying, all of my immediate family is dead. I'm the only one left. And he seems pretty zen about it. But the line, I would give it all the hits back to have them here, That's pretty good. They could have mined that a bit more.
That was touching. That'll take us to our break. When we come back, we'll talk about briefly about Mank on Netflix and as well as The Challenge. Hey, people. While we take a quick break, we'd like to remind you that you can support The Alabama Take and our various podcasts by visiting buymeacoffee.com/TheAlabamaTake and make any sort of contribution. Don't forget to go by the site, TheAlabamaTake.com, and read our year-end writings that will be coming soon, as well as our weekly coverage of The Challenge, brought to you by head writer T.D. Wood every Thursday. Back into it. Adam, you watched Mank.
Good. Orson, don't listen to Mank. Mank, don't listen to Orson. Orson, don't listen to Mank. Mank, don't listen to Orson. Because Orson likes to dance, dance, dance. And Mank likes to rest, rest, rest.
That's pretty much it.
Okay, well, there you go. All right, moving on. So what'd you think? Was it any good?
I thought it was pretty good. I couldn't, for the listener, I couldn't convince my my pals here to watch it. But they're busy or something. I don't know.
Dear listener, I didn't do jack shit for this podcast. I shouldn't even be on here.
Well, I'll admit the blemish on my record is that I've never seen Citizen Kane. And so I didn't feel like, Mank wouldn't have an impact on me at all if I didn't watch Citizen Kane first. So that means I would have had to do two movies this week in a semi-busy week. So, although I did fit in a Bee Gees documentary, so yeah.
Bee Gees, Citizen Kane.
They're the same thing, yeah?
Yeah, apples.
Mostly.
So Mank's gotten some tepid reviews from my skimming the headlines.
Tell me about these reviews before...
I don't read them because I didn't want any spoilers. I've just seen headlines that say it's okay, it's not that good, it's miscast. I think was one of the headlines that Gary Oldman was miscast. So what do you think?
I can see that. You know, Gary Oldman's great, but it's shot and presented in that very 30s, 40s Hollywood style. It's highly stylized. Fun to watch in that regard. It reminded me a bit of Perry Mason in that old Hollywood kind of vibe. And, you know, it was fun. If you've seen Citizen Kane, you know the beats that are happening and kind of getting inside. When you watch Citizen Kane and you think about Orson Welles being a very young man when that was made, I mean, he was 23, something ridiculous. For it to be almost universally agreed upon that it's the greatest film in the English language, and he cranked it out at that age, and for it to have the depth and the life experience, you're thinking this guy is he was a prodigy, zero doubt about that, but it almost like mystically so to be able to pull that off and to get and this is a famous story of the writer and the guy who gets the credit kind of butting heads, but in that regard it was fun. I don't know that it's like, it's not one of the better movies that I've seen this year, but it was enjoyable.
You recommend it to those who... Would you have a problem seeing it if you'd never seen Citizen Kane?
Yeah, I think so. It relies pretty heavily on the relationships that inform Kane's rise and fall. You know, it was supposed to have been largely biographical or composite characters, at the very least. Mm-hmm. And there's some good explorations with that, but you kind of got to know the Citizen Kane beats to really enjoy it. I'd give it like a C+.
Oh.
Well, just the fact that they gave him a totally blank check almost kind of thing. Like he got final edit approval, all this kind of stuff. It's just crazy. And they talk about him being an outsider. He kind of had to be lured to Hollywood. And Welles is only in it to propel the plot. He's not really featured. He's the guy with the deadline, you know, that shows up and kind of reminds you, oh, this Gary Oldman, Mank, is laying in bed hurt after a car crash and on this deadline, and occasionally Welles will pop by, and that's pretty much it. But the circumstances of it, of of Mank being this old Hollywood hand and Wells coming in as this outsider. They do a good job of that.
My only contribution to this is from a TCM did a podcast with Peter Bogdanovich over the summer. It was really great. And they were interviewing his daughters because Peter Bogdanovich and Orson Welles were friends for a while. And Orson, I think it was while he was cutting The Other Side of the Wind or The Far Side of the Wind, whatever that one was, he was actually living with Peter. And they had Peter Bogdanovich's daughters on to Eddie. He was like, well, Orson didn't really like children, but he really liked ice cream. So like eventually, like, and he'd get into the Haagen-Dazs and eat it all. And one day, like, the little youngest daughter went for the Haagen-Dazs and it wasn't there. And she goes to Peter Bogdanovich and is like, Dad, Orson ate all the ice cream again. You have to do something. And he's like, well, honey, you see, that man is a great director.
Just cruel to children.
I can relate to that so much. The ice cream part. I don't know. Maybe I'm cruel to children as well, but
that man is a great director.
All right. Let's shift gears. Let's bring in our special guest. Let's bring in Miss Natalie Morrow.
Look out, everybody. It's going to be me and Donovan soon. We're kicking these other two out.
I tell you what, I missed out this week. I haven't seen it yet.
I think Donovan would have to do his homework before he can start kicking anybody out.
It's true. I read the Vulture recap of it.
Did you really?
But yeah, I could pay attention.
Oh, well, there was two things with that statement. I didn't know Vulture did recaps of the challenge. I read a lot of their recaps, but I didn't know they did one. But two, I wouldn't have suspected you to do any prep for this.
I want to be part of the conversation. I got to see what's up with Big T.
Well,
this dumbass partner.
This was a huge Big T. Yeah, Big T episode. So, Natalie, kick us off. What were your thoughts? What things do you want to focus on?
Man, I am thrilled about the T's. That's really all I want to talk about is just Big T and CT. This is the greatest thing for somebody like Donovan who comes in, already said Big T is his girl. You know, big fan of Big
T. She is my girl.
But we need him to get the background story and everybody else. So for her to get paired with CT, this is perfect. It's perfect.
See, I saw that happen. I'm like, this is good for me with CT because, like, I want to see how their personalities work together too.
Well, CT is probably the greatest partner in challenge history.
Right. How? He's the backpack guy, right? Like, he's the guy that just lifted that other man like a backpack.
Hey, there you go.
That's incredible. Yeah.
He has taken lackluster partners very deep into the competition more than once and is, for all of his early years getting kicked off the show for fighting and just generally being a dick, he was always kind and uplifting to his partner.
You know, we say kicked off for fighting like it's a bad thing.
Well, there was a clear rage problem for a lot of years that he was always strangely gentle with people close to him like that.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be a strategy for some of the dudes that knew they couldn't beat CT in a competition was, let's just get him to punch me, and then he gets sent home. So that's how we get rid of him.
That makes
and
sense.
And we see this season, or this next episode, it looks like Josh may be trying that strategy, and I don't think it's going to work
back
for
away,
him.
Josh. Back away.
What's the chance that, like, has anyone gotten punched by CT and, like, okay, yeah, he goes home, but also, like, he broke their jaw? Because
yeah.
He's a big guy.
Yeah, that's happened.
That seems like you're playing with real fire there.
Oh, he's hurt people on the show.
And I mean, if your strategy is to get him to punch you, that is, like, I think at the end of the day, it's a little bit on you.
Yeah. I mean, he did what you asked him to do, and not,
that's
not
what
you're
I'm
medically
saying.
Disqualified.
Like you achieved your goal, so you got the desired outcome.
Yeah, that should be a last straw strategy for anyone. Let's back up, though. The challenge, the game, whatever you want to call it, where they swam to the boat, they grabbed a block of ice, they chopped it away, put in a kill pill, as they called it, just a tube. What the hell were they thinking? Why not put it in Fessy and Anissa's? I didn't understand that. My head never wrapped around why you wouldn't just put them out as well.
This is my least favorite kind of game, I think, on the challenge, where they're clearly angling. It's not a physical thing. I mean, it is, but you can't really outwork someone else and win. if the House turns against you. It's pure politics. So I appreciate any time that they do something that gets somebody medically DQ'd. That's a good time. Have them jump in freezing cold water. I love it. But I feel like they're just trying to use Fessy and Anissa as like this figurehead to absorb blame and kind of do their bidding. But that lasted 1 week before they realized that they all wanted different things, right? Is that your read on it?
Yeah, for sure. And I actually saw, I'm the one who watches like the live Instagram feed interviews after the fact, hosted by Devin, a previous challenger who's really great. But Anissa actually talked about that they, she and Fessy decided as they were, you know, chipping open their block, you know, why rush? Let's just stand here and get to the point where we're here when everybody else has to make their decision. And nobody wanted to make that decision to put it in their whatever, their box, with them standing right there. So that was just kind of their game. Let's just hang out and nobody's going to do anything. And that's exactly what happened.
Certainly didn't help Wes as he stood there and cussed people as they were putting them in his.
Poor Wes.
Yeah, or no, it depends on how you view Wes. And that takes us into the behind the scenes deliberation or the build up to the deliberation. And we got Joseph, quote unquote, working out on the floor while everyone's having breakfast. And he's more or less just kind of wallowing in the floor.
I don't, you know,
in jeans, right? He's wearing jeans for this whole
thing. It could have been.
Like it was something very odd.
Joggers at best, I think.
You've got to have the personality to put yourself on a reality show twice over, because he was on
America's Got Talent.
America's Got Talent.
Mm-hmm. A singer.
That's a specific kind of reality show, too. That he's a different blood than the other contestants.
You know,
here.
They basically just live in a CrossFit gym at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, like they have beds and they have the breakfast room and they have a geodesic dome that they can go drink in. But the rest seems to be dedicated to physical fitness. And this dude chose to do his core exercises beside the breakfast table.
Which those core exercises did not look very hard. They did not. I could have done those, and I'm not very in shape.
He claims that he's got to get to 1,000. Isn't that what he said?
And something like that. I wasn't buying it.
It reminded me of when Don is doing push-ups next to the bed and Betty walks in and he's on like 3 and then he says 98, 99, 100. same vibe going on there.
Very much.
This dude, the trick of the challenge, if you really want to kind of make it boring, is look at who's getting the screen time in an episode. The fact that this like minor player got so much screen time this week, you kind of know he's probably going to go home or he's going to pull off an incredible upset. It's one of the two. You don't really get a lot of in between. So the writing was on the wall for poor Joseph, Jacob, whatever his name.
Natalie, does Nam look as dominant to you as he does to me?
What do you mean by look? Are you just staring at him the whole time?
Like, yeah, kind of, because he just looks so, he looks so physically imposing that he's kind of scary. Like if CT goes up against him in like a hall brawl, I would be afraid for my boy.
CT would destroy in a hall brawl.
There's a certain like people can come in and be like gym strong, but that doesn't always translate into challenge strong.
Mm-hmm. They don't want to be
fairly strong. It's fast and strong, right?
Well, I thought the same thing of Fessy last year, and he did finish third. He did very well for a rookie, right?
He did, and I'm not going to defend Fessy much, especially after this episode, but big guys at altitude, you know, there's something to that. That's tough for them. CT has struggled on mountains before. Zach, who hasn't been on in a couple of years, very athletically dominant for most of a season and struggled at altitude. So, you know, but Fessy this episode, there was some cowardly behavior all around, I thought. I mean, not going in, you talk about him being the physically probably most imposing guy on the show at this point.
He's one of three, I would imagine.
I mean, just, I bet he outweighs Nam by a good bit. You know, Nam is probably not that he's small, but he's all muscle, and I think Fessy has played D1 football. He's huge. I don't know that there's many people in the show's history that could take him out in a hall brawl. And he says, I'm not going down unless there's, what do you say, a stick in the sand, or it's a hall brawl. And they go in, and it's just a different shaped piece of metal, and he won't go in.
Yeah, a big mistake by him, if you ask me.
Not good. And, you know, they seem to understand quicker last year that there is a limited supply of, you have to go in. You know, there's a limited supply of skulls. Maybe they're banking on the fact that they can steal skulls later, and they're trying to stay out until an opportune moment. But the more I thought about it, you know, if you read TD's weekly article, you'll see me and Blaine's thoughts there at the bottom. Big Kyle fan here. I don't try to hide that in my wrap-ups. Him getting sent down early, maybe not the worst thing. Maybe he can kind of sit back now.
I want to comment on the 10 skulls thing. So they put a number on them this year, or this season. That makes me worry that there's going to be a shorter amount of episodes, or a fewer episodes than we've had in previous seasons. Doesn't that seem like that's going to hamper how many episodes we're going to have?
I mean, I think it would probably be similar to like the island, where there was a certain amount of keys, and once the keys were taken, you had to beat somebody in a challenge to steal that key from them. They still had the same amount of episodes, so I think it will be similar to that of, all right, all the skulls are given. We've still got so many players that don't have any. Here are your chances to get one and kick somebody out.
I got you. That would be that would make for interesting TV as well. So now we're talking elimination. Kyle goes in, and we get some swapping. Here's where the double agent stuff's happened. So you guys have comments on the fact that, well, we talked about Big T ended being paired with CT by the way things shook out. You guys have thoughts about Kyle dropping his partner?
I think Kyle making the move that he did is one of the better political moves of the last few seasons. I mean, he totally just shredded that alliance by putting himself with Cam, I think.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, I mean, Nani was already saying she doesn't want to be with him, so that's not like hurt feelings there. I think it's hilarious that Nani is now with Josh, and they're both excited about it, but it's not good for either of them. But yeah, I mean, when Kyle was standing there, Adam looked at me and he said, who's he going to pick? And in my head, I'm like, if he's smart, he's going to pick Cam. There's plenty of other options that would have been good for him, but Cam is the best pick. Cause like you said, it's going to split that alliance and it's going to put him in the alliance. So yeah, I thought it was a brilliant move by old Kyle.
And we get a vintage Josh reaction of being a big baby about what happened.
Awful.
How he didn't end up in tears is a surprise.
I think that's for next week.
Even TJ says that he cries a lot. So, well, that's a wrap on the challenge. It is, it's holiday week, Christmas week specifically, but it's a week of holidays, or wrapping up holidays, and also a week of year-end list on the Alabama Take. If you have one, if you want to share one, let us know. We'll get your list up on the Alabama Take. We're going to be talking about our favorite things of 2020 and our least favorite things. And next week on the Alabama Take, we're probably going to be talking about Wonder Woman 1984 and maybe even our favorite. I'm going to hear from Adam and Donovan on their favorite shows or things in general of the year, as my favorite shows will be posted throughout the week. Hope you join us then, and we'll hear from you later.